Hello, and welcome to the Life Science Report, a podcast from Back Bay Life Science Advisors. My name is Pete Bach, and I'm a managing director here at Back Bay in Boston. And today, as always, I'm joined by my colleague and director here at Back Bay, Christian Thienel. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks, Pete. It's always a lot of fun.
Indeed, indeed. So, we've gone a number of podcasts on our monthly catch-ups without talking about the one space that has garnered potentially the most significant amount of industry interest over the last couple of years, and that is the anti-obesity space, particularly the staggering success of Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly's GLP-1 agonists. So there's a lot to be said, perhaps on a later podcast, about the scientific and clinical development in anti-obesity medications, and certainly the commercial and pricing and market access space as well. But today, we thought we'd talk with each other a bit about the newer approaches in anti-obesity medications, particularly the paths that are being explored in combination with the GLP-1s. Maybe to kick us off and briefly sort of level set and give a lay of the land, Christian, you can give a little background very briefly on the GLP-1s.
Sure. That sounds good, Pete. I think, you know, most people are, I'd be very surprised if any of our listeners are not aware or haven't heard of these products before, just given that, you know, they're all over industry news. So any kind of, you know, media outlet has covered these in you know, varying ways. Basically, the two are, you know, semaglutide from Novo Nordisk, which the brands are Ozempic, which is the technically indicated for type 2 diabetes, or Wegovy, which is the obesity one. They're the same thing, basically. And tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro or Zepbound from Lilly. You know, basically the thing that was really notable with both of these drugs, in addition to the kind of, you know, major adverse cardiac outcomes data that they showed, was really the weight loss benefit. And that's, you know, been the big thing that people have been talking about. You basically, across the clinical studies for semaglutide, had, you know, somewhere between 10% to, you know, almost as much as 20% reduction in body weight, you know, across a number of those studies and clinical trials. You know, people have seen more than this in the real world, but that really was a huge leap forward. And with Zepbound, you know, pretty similar, but actually, if you know, you can cross compare across the clinical trials, and we won't tell any of the KOLs or physicians that are the data wonks that we're comparing between two clinical trials without matched controls. But there was a, you know, slightly bigger difference in placebo adjusted weight loss with Zepbound versus Wegovy. And you know, so we'll see, you know, from the kind of consumer demand side of things, if that materializes into an actual difference in, you know, utilization. But for now, they're both kind of completely taking off. There's, you know, demand that is outpacing supply in a lot of cases. And the other interesting thing with Zepbound is it also has activity against GIP, which I think we'll talk about, which, you know, might be driving some of that difference in its clinical profile.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the story here about these molecules, probably, I'm sure there's going to be a book or five written about it, sort of across the history of development and the commercial rollout. And, you know, we could probably have a podcast or two all about sort of the manufacturing and very tactical rollout of these drugs as well. And again, if you read the industry literature and analysts, they're expecting, you know, these drugs to have north of $150 billion in sales globally. So we've talked about GLP-1s, and you've just mentioned GIPs. So as we're going to talk about, you know, other mechanisms that are meant to complement these, maybe we can just briefly also talk about what these pathways are actually doing in the body.
Sure. So, you know, I think we'll be relatively kind of brief and high level with this bit of it. But the short answer is that, you know, GLP-1 agonists stimulate production of insulin. It's kind of the main, or, you know, the most known pathway. And that's kind of what explains their ability to control blood sugar or HbA1c in type 2 diabetes. But the mechanism of action in weight loss is a little bit less clear in exactly how it's working there. You know, just because of, for some brief background, you know, GLP-1 or glucagon-like peptide 1 stimulates production of more insulin in the body via the GLP-1 receptor on pancreatic beta cells. You know, the hormone's mainly produced in the gut and secreted into the bloodstream, you know, after consumption of food that contains, you know, fats, protein hydrolysate, or glucose entering the duodenum. You know, some of the first GLP-1 agonists that were available, you know, in type 2 diabetes were exenatide, which was branded as Byetta, or Bydureon, which had a slightly different dosing schedule, and Victoza, which was liraglutide. Victoza was notable in particular because it was the first GLP-1, and I think the first, it might have been the first product in type 2 diabetes to show benefits on cardiovascular outcomes, which really led to a big amount of utilization of the class, and I think sparked a lot of this interest in the GLP-1 mechanism more broadly. And it had a weight loss benefit in clinical studies in diabetes, you know, somewhere between like 2 and 3 kilograms per patient on average. So not quite the same order of magnitude that we're talking about with current GLP-1s. But I think, you know, that did, you know, also create some of the interest in looking further into this mechanism for weight loss specifically. You know, interestingly, Novo has, you know, had a version of liraglutide branded as Saxenda, which was indicated for obesity, you know, many, many years ago. But it really wasn't that effective, and it wasn't used nearly on the same, you know, level that current ones are. In terms of the weight loss mechanism, the sort of prevailing hypothesis right now is that GLP-1s induce weight loss generally by lowering energy intake. You know, there's an association with reduced food cravings, which other GLP-1s have, you know, was not seen with liraglutide. The kind of thought is that there's some involvement of GLP-1 in vagal nerve stimulation and signaling, as well as in motility and gastric emptying. So I think, you know, the sort of role of GLP-1 in the kind of nervous system and GI, I think, is still kind of being elucidated. But that is the prevailing thought, is that basically there is that impact on the feeling of satiety and also, you know, potentially gastric emptying, you know, physically. GIP, or gastric inhibitory polypeptide, it's pretty similar in terms of like the type of hormone that it is and what it does kind of endogenously. It is, you know, also secreted following, you know, nutrient ingestion. It acts on pancreatic beta cells as well. And again, it stimulates insulin secretion. And also, it is not entirely clear how that, you know, stimulates weight loss. But there's a similar type of data that's emerged around this kind of gut CNS kind of activity of GIP as well that affects, you know, sort of the you know, food intake in I think it was in a rodent studies and body weight, especially when it's co-administered with GLP-1. So there's something going on that is, you know, impactful, obviously, with both of these mechanisms here. But it's really not entirely clear what exactly it is to this point.
Understood. So, you know, obviously these are, you know, very, very successful drugs so far. And again, the clinical data sort of bears out a number of benefits, not only from weight loss, but beyond. And again, you sort of alluded to areas in which they're being tested much beyond metabolic and endocrine diseases, like in the CNS. But again, when we think about these assets and products and how people are trying to combine them, what are they trying to solve for at the end of the day?
Yeah. I think there's the kind of the main things are really around, you know, certainly the tolerability side of things. I think the, you know, safety profile of GLP-1s have been something that's been, you know, a bit of a concern, you know, for many years as they were used in diabetes, particularly around sort of GI related side effects, like mostly nausea and vomiting. Mm-hmm. You know, I think as you know, mentioned a minute ago, you know, that delay in gastric emptying is one of the reasons why, you know, people think that there is an impact on nausea and vomiting. It is, I think, hard to solve for that when that's part of the reason that they're working. So, and also the kind of that impact on motility there. So I think that's one of the key ones that, you know, we're looking into how that can be mitigated, because that is one of the leading causes as well of kind of discontinuation of GLP-1s, as they've looked at these kind of real world studies in obesity patients. I think another big one that people have talked about has been, you know, muscle mass. So kind of one of the major issues is that sort of the weight loss is kind of indiscriminate to, you know, lean versus fat mass in the body. And you've seen a lot of, you know, patients both, you know, losing body fat as well as muscle or lean mass. I think the interesting thing though is that, at least from some of the research that we've seen and some of the equity coverage of sort of physician interviews around this issue, that despite there being, you know, a loss in lean muscle mass, patients generally have a higher ratio of lean body mass to total body mass after the weight loss with treatment. So I think from the physician perspective, it's kind of like let's take the win on this situation where this is a better outcome than before. But I think, you know, and as you know, maybe therapies move towards maybe patients that are, you know, obese on in a technical BMI sense, but maybe less severe or less pronounced, I think that this sort of muscle mass piece might become increasingly important. And I think a lot of certainly a lot of kind of activities, I think, as we'll get to, and people looking into this. And then obviously the kind of long-term efficacy, you know, remains a bit of a question. You know, there's some emerging data around, you know, there not being that same bounce back effect of, you know, not gaining the weight back following discontinuation, which was a kind of recently published study looking at patients after about a year after discontinuing semaglutide or liraglutide. But again, you know, it's one study. You need to see how that kind of plays out. And I think there, you know, obviously there's going to be quite a large, you know, population of treated patients and data to look at there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So with that being said, our brief introduction, which has gone on for a while, but I think all important to sort of level set, maybe you can talk a little bit about the, you know, some of the more novel or differentiated approaches that are being used in combination here.
Yep. I think it's a really interesting kind of piece of things. So, I mean, one of the main ones I think that people have been looking at has been amylin. So it's actually, you know, another pancreatic hormone that's, you know, been around for a while. You know, there was an approved, you know, amylin asset called Simlin, approved in 2005 for patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes as an adjunct to mealtime insulin. I think one of the, you know, kind of prevailing issues there was that it's not a particularly potent molecule. The half-life is pretty short. It didn't have great bioavailability. It had like 3 times a daily subcutaneous administration, you know, as it was meant to be used alongside meals. But I think as things have kind of now kind of shifted to at a minimum once daily and also kind of once weekly, you know, administration, that's really not a fit in kind of where things have evolved, certainly in the obesity space. So, you know, some of the kind of interesting approaches that have been looked at on the amylin side here are, I think the farthest along one is, you know, Novo Nordisk's combination of CagriSema. So it's basically, you know, semaglutide with cagrilinotide, which is also an amylin targeting asset. I think the interesting thing there is that, you know, cagrilinotide is currently being administered as a separate injection to semaglutide. So whether they can, from a formulation issue, sort of solve that problem, I think remains to be seen. You know, obviously, you know, would be an important one there. And as, you know, I'm sure we can all imagine, you know, this is obviously a really critical space for Novo Nordisk. So it's one they're going to continue to invest in there. And as we've seen, they've been really active as well from the BD front in this. And then you have Zealand, which is a little bit behind this, but they have a sort of once weekly administered peptide called petrelintide. And I think they're pretty confident that they could, you know, easily co-administer that in a single injection with, you know, in combination with a GLP-1. So, you know, they're a little bit earlier on. I think there's data expected in May from an ongoing phase 1B. So kind of establishing that clinical proof of concept there, but certainly a lot of activity in the amylin space.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see their sort of the product positioning play, given the fact that early on they're developing it as a monotherapy, and traditionally the AZ asset was developed there. But, you know, sort of strategically from the company perspective, how they play that out will be interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe moving from amylin, which is still in the pathway of, you know, acting either on the CNS or in the gut, to maybe hitting another type of tissue, we can talk about muscle-targeted approaches. So myostatin and activin. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. I think, you know, myostatin and activin are both, you know, TGF-beta ligands. They have a, you know, role in skeletal muscle mass and bone and erythropoiesis that have been, you know, pretty well established over the years. You know, I think myostatin's been one of the key targets here, with, you know, bimagrumab from Lilly and Versantis, as well as, you know, Regeneron has an antibody trevogrumab, which is a myostatin inhibitor they're using in a combination with another activin A inhibitor. I think the interesting thing here is, like, both of these assets are ones that have had prior issues, or in the case of the garetosmab, has had, like, you know, prior failures and other indications, but are ones here that we're seeing renewed interest in. Given, you know, some of the new focus on, you know, myostatin and sort of muscle building approaches alongside, or at least prevention of muscle loss alongside the sort of weight loss therapies here. So maybe we can just start off talking a little bit about bimagrumab. So that's that hits activin type 2 receptor. You know, historically, that was actually a product developed by Novartis originally. They divested it to Versantis in 2021, and then Lilly wound up buying it at a pretty big, you know, pretty big structure deal. Recently. It's currently in a large phase 2 study in combination with semaglutide. There's primary completion expected in next month. So I think it'll be interesting to see sort of what that looks like and how that changes things up in the field here, as certainly has been a ton of focus on the GLP-1 mechanism. But in terms of what comes next, I think this will be a really key data point in there, and, you know, other mechanisms and how that evolves things. And I think one really interesting thing as well is that bimagrumab is currently an IV, or it's at least being developed as an intravenous product, which, you know, in this market, I think that could be pretty limiting. And, you know, even though it's basically every 12 weeks after an initial dose of semaglutide every week, there's a 4-week period, and then it's every 12 weeks for bimagrumab. Lilly is doing a phase one trying to test a sub-Q dose, and they've seen similar efficacy, I think, in healthy volunteers. But I think one of the critical pieces here, you know, certainly from a marketing and commercialization point of view, is going to be whether they can convert that into a subcutaneous, just given the challenges. And then we also mentioned the kind of Regeneron assets. So garetosmab was an asset that they had looked at a number of years ago in a rare bone disorder. It didn't have a clear efficacy and safety signal. They wound up kind of shelving the program, and wasn't really anything heard from it. And basically, until some data was released recently, it is now clear where that one has gone. And, you know, similarly acting on the kind of activin pathway, and they had some good data in kind of postmenopausal women showing a decrease in android fat mass, as well as some really good data from, you know, non-human primate model with really significant weight loss in combination with this trevogrumab antibody that they're also bringing along. So we'll see with, you know, that one is a little bit behind bimagrumab, but I think in terms of the activity in the space is, I think, another key one to keep an eye on. And you also have Biohaven and Scholar Rock with some also phase two programs targeting this same pathway of myostatin. So kind of a lot of development all of a sudden in this area.
Yeah, it's interesting. Those have been studied for a while in a number of different diseases. And I remember looking at some of those assets, you know, back 7 years or so in the context of muscle wasting disease. So again, we're sort of, a lot of people talking about them as novel and new approaches here in the context of obesity, and certainly that application is, and even with amylin, you know, these are known applications that are now being reimagined, call it, in a new context. So, and I think similar to that, we had talked about GLP-1s and GIPs right at the outset, but again, we didn't talk about another one in sort of that energy metabolism hormonal pathway, and that's a glucagon receptor. And again, a few people looking at that in the context of combinations with GLPs, or even, you know, with Lilly, a triple combo with a GLP, a GIP, as well as folks like BI and Zealand are partnered up with a combo looking at the glucagon receptor as well as Altimmune as well. So maybe, again, we're talking about, you know, obesity and weight loss in the context of type 2 diabetes, as well as, you know, non-diabetic obesity. But there's also been a long history of drug development in genetic obesity. So just mainly, again, that's potentially a topic for a whole nother podcast, but maybe just briefly talk about, again, from the context of pathways and targets, what's been looked at there.
Yeah, I think there's certainly been, you know, some activity there historically. I think, you know, you have the likes of like a Rhythm Pharma with IMCIVREE, who's looked at chronic weight management in, you know, patients with a few rare kind of deficiencies in, I guess, POMC, PCSK1, and LEPR. I think you also, you know, have a lot of focus on kind of leptin and the kind of leptin-associated pathway there. Mm-hmm. That is one of the, I think the one interesting thing one there is that that's one of the pathways that could be kind of translatable to the broader obesity market versus, you know, some of these specific subtypes where it's genetically defined and there's a mutation, and obviously that's causal, but it's not necessarily something that is implicated in the same way in you know, obesity at, you know, writ large. So yeah. I think it'd be interesting to see there if there's any of those companies can kind of, you know, take that activity there and start to, you know, position things towards broader markets as well, or whether on the flip side there is, you know, as people start to think more about the space, instead of, you know, how do we get the next GLP-1 and compete on, you know, for this, you know, chunk of a large pie, maybe there's more focus that comes into the sort of rare side of things as well, as you know, we've seen in some other spaces as well.
Yeah. And so we've talked a lot about assets that, you know, are fairly, and pathways, fairly well along in the clinic. But from a business development standpoint and investor interest standpoint, if we look sort of earlier on in the clinic, what have we been seeing from a strategic standpoint or an investor standpoint? Where have they been placing down markers? We talked, you know, at the outset, the Lilly Versantis deal. What else has been going on the BD front?
Yeah, I think, you know, as probably everyone's aware, there's a ton of activity that is still going on. I think, you know, it's almost surprisingly for GLP-1s themselves. You've had some, you know, really big deals from Roche. There was a big announcement of a, you know, large kind of ARC company emerging today with a, I think, almost a $300 million kind of initial funding for a GLP-1 portfolio.
And a lot of that for orals, which we haven't talked about today, which again, not to keep repeating myself, is potentially a topic for another podcast. But anyway.
Yeah. So aside from those, which there's certainly been a ton of BD activity there, I think you are seeing, you know, a number of the big players here expanding to looking at other novel mechanisms that, and I think it'll be interesting to see from a positioning point of view, whether these are, you know, I would assume combination type therapies, but if it's also, you know, maybe in patients where they are looking for an alternative mechanism or kind of a sort of a, you know, positioning in patients that might be refractory or not responding as well to GLP-1s, I think we'll see kind of how that all plays out. But one of the interesting ones I think we've seen was deal with Novo Nordisk and Versago. They have kind of a next generation, kind of best in class cannabinoid one receptor inverse agonist portfolio. So, you know, I think, you know, obviously people have looked at the kind of cannabinoid pathway for a number of indications and in a number of ways over the years. I think, you know, there was always some thought that there, in terms of like kind of impulse control and behavioral things, there could be some implication of that pathway there. I think the real idea with these CB1 antagonists and inverse agonists is around, you know, appetite reduction and increase in metabolism, which, you know, it seems like this kind of, you know, the satiety element of the GLP-1 series seems to be where a lot of that focus is on, you know, where do we go next and how do we kind of continue building on that element of things? Yeah. Because I think from like anecdotally, that's a lot of what patients are really like about these therapies is that they don't have like cravings as much anymore. They're not feeling like that they, you know, are they feel full more easily. So I think that one is interesting, you know, that in that, you know, Inversago is looking at diabetic kidney disease as well. And I think they've, you know, it was a really interesting and notable one in terms of, again, an alternative mechanism. And Novo also has done a much earlier deal as well with a company called Embark, which was an EMB1 receptor agonist. That's a mechanism that stimulates energy expenditure and reduces food intake as well. So again, I think adding on these sort of, you know, potentially additive or synergistic mechanisms with how we believe that GLP-1s work kind of is interesting there. But again, that was a much, much earlier preclinical deal as well. So I think it's pretty clear that, you know, Novo is certainly reinvesting, I guess, small percentage of the, of the revenues here, but, you know, it's going to obviously continue to be an important space for them and expect them to be really active.
Okay.
And then on the financing side, you know, what are the other, obviously Lilly being a key player here, their venture arm invested in a $60 million Series A in November of last year for a company called OrsoBio, which is a clinical stage company focused on novel targets in metabolic disorders. Their lead is an acetyl-CoA carboxylase 2 inhibitor, which is a sort of fatty acid oxidation regulator who regulates entry of those fatty acids into mitochondria.
Yeah.
Their portfolio is really all mitochondrial targets, and it's all novel mechanisms. And really their, you know, initial focus is on a type 2 diabetes asset, but sort of the next ones behind that are all sort of obesity and metabolic disease focused, and they've really kind of positioned it as a metabolic diseases company as well. And had some interesting, I think, preclinical data for those obesity assets in terms of, you know, weight reduction and treated mice. And I think, you know, interesting to see then that, you know, not only on the kind of BD front and transactions, but also strategic, you know, corporate venture also playing a role in moving things forward here.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see that mitochondrial story because for a while, you know, certainly a lot of interest in targeting the mitochondria for, you know, some of the rare diseases that affect the mitochondria. So how those assets or, you know, avenues may be pursued in the context of obesity will be interesting. Well, great. I think we'll leave it there, Christian. Thanks for the tour through what's been happening, both from late stage and early stage. And it'll be particularly interesting to see how things shake up. So given, you know, the success, the huge success of these drugs, it'll be interesting to see that we expect more early stage VC flowing here, not only to startups, but also to you know, into the academic realm, and it'll be interesting to see what other novel, you know, science begins to emerge. Because again, it's happened so quickly that a lot of these later stage assets are from known assets that have been de-risked to some extent in early stage clinical development in other areas. So they've been able to move pretty quickly into the obesity space. So as more targets emerge, it'll be interesting to see what pathways they hit.
Yeah, but I think it's also a bit of a, you know, we'll see like what the next indications are where there's good data. I think you just today, there was a positive phase 3 in sleep apnea. There's been emerging data about GLP-1s and Parkinson's. I think it's, the world is their oyster at this point, but I don't know, at least it's, you know, be interesting to see how if they expand outside of kind of the, you know, obesity, type 2 diabetes and metabolic diseases, you know, where that, what that means for everything else that's out there.
We will not even discuss the potential knock-on effect to other industries that people have fantied about, be it the effect on fast food chains or better gas efficiencies for planes as more and more people get on.
Yeah, a lot of work for the health economists to do on that side of things, I think.
Yeah. So, but again, we're certainly interested in revisiting some of these issues that we teased and talked about. So if there are any questions or areas you'd like us to explore in metabolic disease and obesity, please do let us know. Head over to the podcast page on our website and submit your question at www.bblsa.com/podcasts. That's bblsa.com/podcasts. We look forward to hearing from you.